Welcome to The Unconventional Path, entrepreneurship and innovation stories and ideas. Hello, I'm Bela Musitz, coming to you from the Capital Region campus of Clarkson University in Schenectady, New York. I am a former three-time entrepreneur, venture capitalist, and now the David D. Ray Professor of Innovation and Entrepreneurship here at Clarkson University.
And coming to you from Münster, Germany, I'm Mike Wasserman, Professor of International Management of the Münster University of Applied Sciences. Thanks for joining us today. We hope you enjoy our podcast. The two of us want to take our lessons learned over three decades plus as entrepreneurs, inventors, investors, managers, and professors, and share our network of interesting friends, former students, business partners, and others we've met along the way in our life's journey to bring you interesting stories, ideas, and insights into innovation, entrepreneurship, and most importantly, people that take unconventional paths to find happiness and success at work and in life.
Before we get to today's guest, just a quick thank you to our sponsors, Clarkson University
and the Münster University of Applied Sciences.
Today's guest is Ewan Poon, a very successful entrepreneur who started and recently sold Spin. It's a great story of how he attended Cornell University at the age of 15, stayed there for a law degree, and then went to work for one of the top New York City law firms. From the law firm, he took a sabbatical and launched his entrepreneurial career.
Okay, let's get right to the interview, Bela, with Ewan Poon, founder of Spin. But just a quick note, this was recorded over Skype, so the sound quality is less than perfect. We hope you'll bear with us.
Hello, listeners. Bela Musitz here with a great guest today for our podcast. A really, really interesting background and story, and a very, very successful entrepreneur. Graduated from Cornell Law at the age of 22, enrolled there, and got accepted at the age of 15. So a really special individual here. And my guest today is Ewan Poon. And Ewan, welcome.
Thank you. Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, sure. It's our pleasure. So let me start off by asking you a question, Ewan. If you're at a social event, a cocktail party or a networking event, and you walk up to someone to introduce yourself, what do you say?
These days, it's the founder of Spin, the electric scooter company, and the conversation usually kind of goes on from there because these scooters have basically taken on a life of their own, and everyone seems to either know them, have an opinion of them, or just generally have heard of them.
Yes. So for those people who may not know what a scooter is and what Spin does, can you expand on that a little bit for us, please?
Sure. So our mission is to solve last mile mobility, and we do that by deploying a fleet of electric scooters. These are, if you guys are familiar with the Razor scooters of old, these are the same L-shaped devices, essentially skateboards with stems on them, but powered by electric motors so that they zip along at a nice speed of 15 miles an hour. And we deploy fleets of them in cities and campuses that you can rent for a pretty small amount. It's $1 to start and 15 cents a minute. And you can zip around town, and when you're done, you basically park them on the sidewalk or in a designated parking area, and you're done your trip. So everything is done via a mobile phone, and this phenomenon has been sweeping the nation, really, starting in Santa Monica by another competitor. We started in San Francisco, now there are a few companies that are taking this into cities and really helping people get around their downtown areas.
Wow, so that sounds living where I live, it's a little remote. We don't have those types of challenges, but it sounds really interesting. And before we dive into that a little bit more, because we're going to want to talk about the challenges and sort of, but first I want to think about sort of a little bit more about your background. So sure. Where were you born?
I was born in Singapore, pretty far out there.
Okay. Yeah.
Island.
And then you ended up in Canada. Is that right?
I did, actually. At the age of 10, family moved to Vancouver. I guess that's where I ended up picking up the hockey bug, and was there for high school before heading off to the cold upstate New York for college and law school.
Yes, and so you went to Cornell University and at the age of 15. So tell me a little bit about that experience.
It was fun. I think that I had, in moving from Singapore to Vancouver and changing different educational systems, I ended up skipping over a couple of grades. But I found I picked up programming at an early age as well, and found it had a decent knack for it. So bumped along very quickly and was pretty excited to get to the next phase of education and got into CS at Cornell. Cornell was a fun experience. I learned a lot, as with any kind of, had a pretty normal still college experience, and learned a lot, and also had a great time in law school, kind of getting a different experience.
Yeah, so I think about, you know, graduating with a degree in computer science, and then most people would not think, okay, the next step for me is I'm going to go to law school. So share with us sort of a little bit of your thinking process there.
The year was 2003 and a half. I guess I graduated in December 2003, which you might recall was the time when Facebook started rolling out to college campuses. And at that point, I think I'd been programming, you know, since the age of 10 or so, which in retrospect, from 10 to 18 didn't seem like a long time, but for me, it was an eternity. And, you know, so looking at some different options, including potentially, you know, applying for a job at Vanda Mason, you know, Facebook or some of the tech startups back in the day, it didn't feel like I wanted to jump into engineering as a profession, but rather I enjoyed creating things for myself. I was almost stuck in that. I think it was a bit of sort of decision paralysis, not knowing what to start. And at the time, my sister had gone to law school and was a pretty successful lawyer herself. It seemed like a really interesting opportunity to learn pop into a different field and gain an understanding of different perspective on the world. And it was also, you know, another good reason to stay at school for another 3 years, which honestly wasn't that bad of a time.
Yes, yes. So is there sort of a history of entrepreneurship or entrepreneurial activities in your family?
There is, actually. I mean, Singapore is a pretty entrepreneurial country. If you know a little bit of the history and the culture there, it's essentially a country full of people who've, you know, trade. It's a trading port historically, and then my dad was in the trading business, started as an accountant and grew a pretty successful trading company of all sorts of things, including plastics and who knows what between. Factories in China, North America, and rest of Southeast Asia. And I've always grown up in that environment. And personally as well, I think that from pretty young age, I was making websites and trying to figure out how to, you know, earn money online. And very much akin to many of the entrepreneurs you might meet today who grew up in the late 90s and had access to the internet and had the exposure there. It's really fascinating. I mean, the internet itself opened the doors for a lot of anyone really to be an entrepreneur and get going. You have all the tools at your disposal, from education to payment systems to products and contacts. So it's quite, I think my first online business was back in like 98 or so.
Yeah, it is. It is. That's an excellent point, because it is remarkable how the internet has made the world flat, as a very famous mm-hmm. person once said. But also, yeah. It has really taken down barriers and made it so much easier for individuals to start a business or to get into business or test the waters for a business. And if you think about it, you know, it also makes it possible, because you have access to such a large potential market, it makes it possible to have very small niche businesses, which 40 years ago was impossible. because their chances were there wasn't enough people within, you know, 300 miles of where you were who were interested in that. Yep. But now you only need to find 1,000 people throughout the world that are interested in that. And the chances of that are pretty good. So it is a, it certainly is a game changing development and or invention that has, I think, forever changed the world.
Yeah, and one of the most fascinating things I've started in recent years, and along the way, sometimes in between different points in my career, I pick up some small side projects. And one thing that I kind of took a look briefly at was selling on Amazon. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with the fulfillment by Amazon system. Speaking of empowering entrepreneurs, today, selling on Amazon, you could start selling without ever having touched the product. You can line up a supplier on Alibaba of whatever you feel like, whether it's, in my case, I kind of experimented with several things, including tea, product. This was back in the kind of the hustling days. You can get them to ship direct to Amazon. Amazon handles all the fulfillment, and you can start an e-commerce business with without any physical inventory or having owned a warehouse of any sort.
Yeah, and thus very low capital required to get started.
Yeah,
which is, you know, one of those barriers that keep a lot of people out of trying entrepreneurial activities or starting businesses. Is oftentimes there's a high capital cost, but as you just stated, we now have mechanisms that fundamentally, for very little capital, you can get going and test the waters and see if your business idea works. And I think that's one of the most remarkable things that we have in the world.
Yeah. I mean, starting things online, and my first thing I was mentioning back in 98 or so was a website that I actually built to fulfill a need, which is a pretty funny need in retrospect, actually. And when I was growing up, I was fascinated by computer gaming, as most male teens are, and wanted access to the latest computer hardware. My parents were not always supportive of investing capital into buying gaming equipment. And I decided to step around this by creating a website that would review computer hardware. I would say purportedly, but not purportedly. I mean, we actually did reviews and actually garnered the following. And that led to me being able to secure relationships with top manufacturers, including Microsoft and 3DFX and ATI and all these big gaming companies, who would then ship me computer hardware for free, essentially, to review. So that was a fun. I've always kind of tried to think about ways to essentially get what I want, and that entrepreneurship is usually a way to do that.
Yes, it sure is. It's oftentimes people say that one of the definitions of entrepreneurship is the ability to accomplish things without the required resources.
Yep.
Yeah, excellent. So after law school, you went to work at a pretty substantial law firm, I think. Is that correct?
Yeah, Simpson Thacher is one of the oldest law firms in the country. Probably the largest now by headcount of lawyers, is not very close to it. One of the most prestigious white shoe firms, to call it, handling billion-dollar mergers and acquisitions. Very different world from Silicon Valley. You know, that was ivory floors and wooden desks and corner offices and handling. They worked with large private equity clients like KKR and Blackstone. And I think it was quite an experience going from Cornell, and it felt very grown up at the time to step into an office. I think I was pretty young at that time, still 22, 23, and be able to participate in the professional workforce.
Yes, yes. So as you reflect back on that experience at Simpson, Thacher, and Bartlett, what were sort of the one or two big takeaways or things that you learned from that experience?
I think the first thing that comes to mind is work ethic. I think nothing gets you the right experience like, you know, working at an investment bank or working at a big law firm and being able to meet deadlines, proceed with precision, and multitask and handle kind of stressful environments. So that was fun. I think that was a good first step into the professional environment.
And when you made that decision to go to a law firm, so one of the things that my co-host Mike and I always kind of talk about is when you're finished with your education, wherever that may be, for some people it's earlier in life than for others, should you start your entrepreneurial endeavor right away, or should you go, you know, work at a larger organization and learn some of the requisite skills that you may have not learned as part of your formal education, and make the mistakes, you know, at their expense, so to speak, mm-hmm. and then start off on your own business. So what are your thoughts on that?
That's a very kind of interesting question. I have kind of differing thoughts on that. And I think it all depends on the opportunity in front of you. If you were, Zuckerberg is sitting at Harvard and three of the chances start the social network that would take over, I think you go for that obvious opportunity. In my case, I always look to the best opportunity available in front of me. And in certain cases, that happens right away. But in certain cases, it does help to build a network. More importantly, it's a network of people and resources and ideas and learnings that you build throughout a career. I don't think apart from just a pure work ethic, I don't think that being a corporate lawyer necessarily trained me for a path towards entrepreneurship. If I had picked more deliberately, it might have been to go work at a tech company to build a network of fellow engineers and designers and people connected in BC that could accelerate the process. But I was fortunate enough to link up with Y Combinator pretty early on in my entrepreneurial career, and that helped fill in the gaps and kind of went with one of that opportunity.
Yeah. So let's talk about Y Combinator a little bit. So, they're one of the big famous places. And talk to us about your experience, sort of how you got in, how you got introduced, what you learned there and stuff.
I first heard of Y Combinator through Paul Graham's website and essays, and that's how many people actually stumbled upon it in the first time and became a regular reader of Hacker News, which is their online, and the site became a staple of my daily reading. I do recall being in the law firm and reading up on the latest articles on entrepreneurship and the stories of, I think it was probably around Dropbox's era and other founders posting things. It sort of led to how I kind of got involved kind of more. How I jumped in was also opportunistic. I think it was in 2009 when there was the financial crisis hitting Wall Street, and I was lucky enough to actually get the opportunity to take a sabbatical for a year and explore opportunities, which naturally led themselves to entrepreneurship. Basically crashed on a friend's couch in San Mateo, which is right near Palo Alto, and sort of started talking to everyone and anyone that I could in that area. I ended up basically just applying. YC that back then was a bit smaller, I suppose I had impressed Paul Graham and the team there enough with my drive towards building something. I don't think that even to this day, I'm not quite sure what exact idea I pitched initially, but I think that they liked what I wanted. They liked the drive that they seemed to have had back in the day.
Yeah, so clearly, your motivation and your drive and your curiosity and willingness to try new things has sort of been a theme through your right? life. You look at the things that you've done, and do you think that's sort of a required characteristic or trait for entrepreneurs?
I think there are different styles. I think I am a bit of an opportunist. I mean, I started this company, got it through an exit, but you know, looking back, I'm not a transportation expert. I'm not a mobility expert. I've never been in the field before, but I saw I'm a product oriented person. I saw a problem, and I figured out how to mobilize the resources to solve this. I think that there's also, on the flip side, a more focused oriented approach, where someone can become a really expert in a craft which takes decades long of experience and focus, and that in some cases can lead to tremendous success as an entrepreneur as well. So there are different styles and different paths towards being successful in this regard.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, Ewan. And you know, one of the things that has come up in previous episodes that Mike and I have noticed is that for most successful entrepreneurs, they do have this characteristic or trait where they can recognize potential opportunities, they act on them, and then they make sure they have satisfied customers. So it's kind of those three things have been a really common theme for the entrepreneurs that we have been spoken to. You have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that's the very definition of spotting. I think most entrepreneurs deliver a product, and I guess entrepreneurs fall into categories. You either provide a product or a service, and in both cases, they fill a customer need. And I think that not just the idea, but the step of taking the risk associated with acting on an idea, and then sometimes sometimes the things don't pan out. But that's kind of the very definition of entrepreneurship, that I recognize, and I've done that multiple times in my life. And seeing an opportunity and acting and jumping on it with sometimes minimal information. I think that sometimes just this kind of hunch and this idea that something could work.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So you never have all the data or information that you'd like to have, but you got to act on what you have and sort of taking that first step. Because once you take the first step, you're sort of forced to take a step after that. and the sort of progression grows and you end up building something. So go ahead.
Yeah, I was saying that really reminds me of how I ended up starting Spin, actually, back, just kind of on hunches and proceeding on incomplete information and really just going with what I, sometimes they just start compounding each other. I think that when the opportunity is right, you'll start knowing it as different forces pull you in, whether it's different partners wanting to come in, investors, customers, and it kind of snowballs in from there.
Yeah. So let's talk about Spin for a little bit. So can you say a few words about where the initial idea for that came from? Sort of, did you have a eureka moment? Just sort of, the very, very early stages of your thought process there, and sort of when you recognized the opportunity.
This is a fun one. It actually stems, and most businesses, it stems from a personal observation. And for me, I've always noticed any kind of inefficiencies in the world around me, or things that I use on a frequent basis. And I live in San Francisco, and I moved there for Y Combinator and doing a bunch of different startups. At the time, I was had just newly formed a small venture firm and was investing in startup opportunities. I thought that was the best use of my skill set. And I was living in San Francisco, and I had lived in San Francisco pre-Uber and noticed the nightmare of trying to get a taxi back in that time. Uber came along and for the most part solved that problem of getting around, but it still left this gap, and this gap was very evident whenever I wanted to travel a very short distance. and the distance being at like a mile or so or less. You know, calling an Uber oftentimes meant waiting for 4 minutes, paying anywhere from $5 to $10, and being stuck in traffic. So that was a huge pain point, and it left me stuck in SoMa, which it's up and coming industrial-esque neighborhood now being taken over by tech, but it's not the most walkable of places. So I felt for it being very stuck, and this feeling of getting stuck kind of stayed with me, and I was splitting time between China and San Francisco doing while running and growing the venture fund, and living in Beijing one day outside of my apartment. I noticed a new bike share system that had just popped up, and it was these two companies that started by a pretty clever college grad from China who had started on his campus. They had devised this scheme of putting orange and yellow bicycles out on the streets that anyone could unlock. At first, it was very simple mechanical locks that users were supplied with a 4-digit code that can unlock. And the real genius behind the system was, I think we're all familiar, most people are familiar now with in the last few years with station-based bike share systems that require docking stations. New York City has a pretty successful program. London has one too, and most big cities in America have tried this in the last few years. The issue with that, obviously, is that these bikes could only be picked up and dropped off to certain fixed point locations, and you can never have enough of these locations in the city to make the trip worthwhile. In China, the model that popped up was bikes that could be picked up and dropped off literally anywhere close to your doorstep, and it really changed the whole face of the product. It made it incredibly useful, and I remember there was this Starbucks that was close to was not super close. I mean, it was a healthy 20-minute walk away from my apartment that now turned into like a 2-minute bike ride. And I remarked by how simple, how elegant, how brilliant this product and solution was, that I knew that this was solving a problem that I personally had faced, that my friends had recognized, and that would be one that would resonate with customers basically throughout the world. Mobility is one of those nice industries where it's universally applicable. It's nothing inherent in one market or another. Everyone wants to get around. So with that, I think that provided me the spark and inspiration, and stars really kind of lined up. I was in a position with access to a very modest amount of capital from the venture side, and had been in contact with a friend who had just left Lyft. I was keeping in touch with promising fellow entrepreneurs and basically put two and two together and really got going. It was quite a whirlwind at the end of 2016, probably around Christmas time when we started, and really drew on all different aspects of my past experiences, including law, because the one recognition that I made in adapting this, in thinking about adapting this system to the United States, where it was home, I realized that users would certainly use that system product, but I was more concerned about how cities would react to us operating on such a system on sidewalks and public rights of way. And having that policy framework in mind, I realized that, you know, much of the work was as much about working with cities in the U.S. as it was about working with users. So I think that that was the approach we took early on, and it's been proven to be the right way as this program has now been put into place with proper permits in most and a lot of U.S. cities.
Yeah, so that's interesting, because it's one of these businesses that when it pops up, it's not regulated. There isn't an existing sort of structure that people know exactly how to deal with it. And I can imagine that some places would embrace it, but maybe some places would resist. So this notion of working that out so it's not a confrontational but more of a partnership between SPIN and the city was really critical. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about your approach in that?
Yeah, I think that I'm thinking back now. It's funny, we stand today in 2019 and everyone knows about scooters, and we just had, you know, a big conference that just came back from South by Southwest, actually, where scooters took over the town, and there were mayor's conferences on how people wanted to implement mass mobility. But you just rewind back to the start of 2017 when we were just starting out. Nobody had heard of this system in the U.S. And we were the first ones to bring it over. We did a demo 2 years ago at South by Southwest with a bunch of orange-colored bikes. It was super successful with users, and that got us kind of going to our next step. The landscape there was much different. Operating a shared mobility service on city streets, whether bicycles or scooters, the legal framework prior to the latest the regulations being and permit systems being created it was somewhere in between leaving materials on blocking the rights of way to operating a hot dog stand or like sidewalk commerce. Those two sets of regulation applied to our business, and no one knew quite what to make of it. And our initial foray was trying to find the most understanding customer. And in our case, we had two sets of customers, one cities and one users. And in doing our experiment at a little demo in Austin during South By in 2017, it was quite a hit of users, but then we had to go figure out how to sell this idea to cities. And again, a very opportune moment happened for us in July in Seattle. In the summer, Seattle had an old system. It was called Pronto, a station-based bike share system. And they actually just ran out of funds. These systems didn't enjoy incredible usage and had to be subsidized by cities. And they had just actually run out of funds and had to dismantle the system. And so we stepped in and made a pitch to the city council members. And we found quite a warm reception from the city council, given that Seattle is a bike-friendly town. We found the city council member who was a passionate advocate of cycling. So Finn started with regular bikes, and same model as our scooters today, where we put them on the streets and unlock, but we started with regular bicycles. So we found the council member who had a bike in his office and was an advocate for more bikes on the street, and it wasn't that hard of a sell to tell him an idea that we would have very soon fleets of a few thousand bikes on the street that anyone could use, that was affordable, provided a clean mode of transportation, and would really power the city to improve on its transportation system.
So let me ask you a question. As you were going through that, it was making me think about your experience at the law firm. How did that experience mm-hmm. help you in this process?
It certainly did. I mean, having and sometimes I do take it for granted, knowing the ins and outs of how permit making is made. I had took courses in administrative law, obviously, how local governments kind of work, how you interpret the different regulations, how you try to craft new regulations that would permit you to do such things, and speak the language of legislate folks in the legislative branch. So I think that it also gave us a little more authority. I think that back in the back in that time, I think it was just three of us. So having that background certainly made us a bit, a tiny, tiny bit more credible when speaking to folks in the city who took a chance on us and the whole system, and ultimately were rewarded because they helped birth a very, very awesome new industry.
Right, right. Excellent. And Spin, if I remember correctly, this past fall or November or something like that, got acquired by Ford.
That's correct. We are now Ford's micro-mobility unit. And, that was quite a crazy ride. If I count, I think it was around like 18 months or so from when we, rolled out our, basically got started with our product to being acquired by Ford. And it was quite the crazy 18 months, but it was unbelievable journey. And we've now found an incredible partner with Ford and their smart mobility group. And are super excited to be now a part of this this whole family. And at the same time, we very much are still a startup. We've quadrupled the headcount since the acquisition, and are embarking on a pretty ambitious plan to roll out in dozens of U.S. cities across the next year.
So can you talk a little bit about how the initial contact with Ford happened? Did they knock on your door? Did you knock on their door? Sort of talk us through that, because I think entrepreneurs are sort of interested in that. So how does this part of the process work?
For us, looking back, we have to kind of retrace how this one, because everything happened in a whirlwind. In our case, it was reaching out to different OEMs for business development relationships. So we had a business development rep on our team who started conversations, and sometimes you never know where that might lead. In our case, it turned out that Ford Smart Mobility Group was looking was actively unbeknownst to us, obviously, looking to get into the space and looking for the right partner, and we found that synergy in the. And the reason we found that synergy was because of our partnership-oriented approach. Ford is built, is classically known as their goal is to build the world's most trusted company. And in our industry, there have been more aggressive players that have chosen growth for the sake of growth and then have oftentimes been at odds with cities. On the other hand, we've been very cooperative and helped lead the way in creating these permit systems and that made a perfect match for us. And then I think the whole thing kind of went very quickly. I think that a lot of it was actually sparked by perhaps inadvertently by competition popping up in Detroit and giving senior members of the Ford team a firsthand look at the possibilities of micromobility and real problems that they were solving. And they basically realized that this was a segment that they needed to understand more and wanted to really invest in.
Oh, excellent. I think one of the gems in what you said is that it started with a business development relationship, and it really wasn't you guys knocking on the door saying, hey, you want to buy us. Oftentimes it's that relationship. It's a different type of relationship that then leads to this sort of aha, wouldn't it be nice to, maybe get more married than mm-hmm. and become one team than to be separate. So that's great.
Yeah. It's like it goes from like a knowing someone and then in our case, there was a convergence of two different things. And obviously in a complex transaction like this, it takes people from all different parts of the organization to get buy-in, and it oftentimes starts from one single relationship and somewhere else in the organization, maybe higher up, saying, hey, we need to get in the space, do you guys know anyone credible or like that we want to work with? Another guy speaks up and, hey, I'm working with these guys already, how about you put two and two together? And so it's oftentimes keeping that network, and it's almost like building a personal a network. You can think about networking for your company. In job hunting or recruiting or building a startup, You have all these loose relationships that end up working out for you. And I guess the same sometimes applies for your business and company as well. You never know where those might lead.
Yeah, excellent. So I want to switch gears a little bit and talk a little about venture capital. So you've done several startups. They've been backed by VCs. And can you talk about that relationship, what you look for in a venture partner or an investment partner, and what sort of the value adds have been in those relationships?
I think that we've worked with different types of venture firms, and ranging from my very first encounter with venture, which was in 2010, had the opportunity to work with really awesome seed stage venture firms, including First Round Capital, who ended up with a mega hit in Uber, having participated in the seed and Series A of that company. So I think that in terms of what I ended up looking for, oftentimes it was the people that were ready to step up and finance the business. To be honest, I think that in you're always kind of towing the line as an entrepreneur between recognizing an opportunity and waiting for people who can provide the financing in order to start believing in you as well. You know, in my cases, I don't think I looked for people who were ready to step up and fund the business, and who I thought I could get along well with, and who trusted me to run and grow the company. I think that in my circumstance, I don't think I was always kind of flooded with offers. I found enough and the right ones to come along and back the business at the right time.
Yes. The one of the things you said there I thought was interesting, in that a company or a team or a partner that you felt you could work with. Talk mm-hmm. about the importance of that relationship between the founder of a company and let's say the investing partner from a venture fund.
I think that's pretty huge. I think that you, aside from being a capital partner, venture investors oftentimes very influential in the company as well, and it's almost like making an important hire. That's how one should really look at bringing on an investor in the company, especially in an active investor like a venture capital firm. And I think that it gets more and more serious down the line as they start taking up board seats on the Series A and Series B rounds, and they oftentimes can dictate the outcome of a company. And most of the time they're right in line. Sometimes the interests kind of diverge, and it's important to figure out what type of business partner you want to work with, and make sure that the goals are aligned. If the goal is to sell a company within the first few years, that's one type of outcome. And the goal is to potentially build a company that can be the next Google or Facebook. That's another type of outcome. And knowing what resources a particular investor might bring is important. What relationships they might want to bring along with them.
Yeah, excellent. Those are, I know a lot of our listeners are, curious to the whole venture capital game and relationship, mm-hmm. however you want to describe it, and sort of, I was part of a venture fund, co-founder, one of three partners, and we started a fund, and that's still mm-hmm. around, still existing. I'm no longer a partner there, and. One of the things that people don't realize is that even as a small little sub $100 million fund, we would look at 300 to 400 business plans a year and only invest in 5 or 6. And so venture capital gets a lot of press and a lot of sort of fame and fortune but it's really not the only way to fund your business, not the only way to grow your business. And but it gets a lot of press, so people often think, oh, I got to go get venture capital. So where I'm leading to with this is, what was sort of your thought process with, should I get venture capital? Should I not get venture capital? Should I look at different ways of capitalizing my business? Or did you just know from the start, hey, I want to do this, you know, with a VC partner?
When, I mean, for Spin especially, I think I had been in startups and tech long enough to realize the characteristics of a good venture fundable business. And oftentimes, I think those, I think that's a good reality check to ask yourself. And not all businesses are suited for venture capital. Not to say that all businesses are not good businesses. They're great businesses that are not suitable for venture capital. And I think early on in my career, I think in when I first encountered YC, I did have that. Luckily enough, I had some early exposure to getting venture funded and learned what makes a good fundable company. And when I was thinking about when the obviously was starting Spin, it felt extremely like a venture fundable business in that there were high upfront costs, namely the hardware and equipment. Buying bicycles and scooters require a huge capital investment upfront on a speculative market, but one that showed tremendous promise and it was intuitively very exciting and had huge scale. And those things as you probably recognize from your own experience, really key elements of an exciting venture fundable business. And so that was I didn't necessarily set out to start the next venture funded company, but when recognizing it and crafting this opportunity, it was quite obvious that the right thing to do was to try to achieve as much scale as possible quickly. And it turns out it was quite right. I mean, between my competitors and us, I believe we're in the most, the fastest growing tech industry or ever. I think outpacing, judging just by company valuations alone, outpacing delivery, outpacing ride share and others. It's kind of, it's been quite a ride.
Yeah, so you brought up some excellent points there of thinking about what are the characteristics for a venture backable business and making sure your own business meets those sort of characteristics. That is really important. Now, as you've accomplished a lot of stuff in your life here, and one of the things I always like to ask folks is, if you reflect back, what were some of the big key decision points that you made that you think have helped you get to where you are today?
I think that, dropping out of the law firm, taking that opportunity and jumping on top of that sabbatical opportunity and crashing on a friend's couch in San Mateo. Maybe not as much as what I did, but what kind of changed the trajectory of my own entrepreneurship career was the help that I got from my friend network through Y Combinator and the mentors that I met there, really shaped my my thinking and have become some of my closest friends and investors. Actually, Spin was funded by a group of my YC peers, at least on the seed round. It was it was a bunch of friends that I'd got together. So not only did they provide kind of good friendship over the years, they were ready to jump in with capital support when I was ready to get when I stumbled upon this idea.
Yeah. So you and I, we've been going for 47 minutes or so. So I want to start wrapping this up. What are you have maybe one or two or three words of advice or lessons learned for our audience out there?
Yeah, I think that for being an entrepreneur, I think that one of the most important things is to really keep an eye out for true product market fit. And that's between your customers and your product. And it's unmistakable once you see it. It's hard to describe, but when you do see it, things take off in a very, very fast way. So there might be different, again, as I mentioned earlier, there are different styles of entrepreneurship. But for someone whose style is more of an opportunist, like myself, I think that I tend to be on a very hawkish lookout for those types of things. And starting businesses around those types of opportunities is often quite powerful, just because of the effects that come along with it.
Excellent, excellent words of advice. So, what's next for Ewan?
We are still growing. We've been an almost busy year after the Ford acquisition. Now, growing as part of this large company. We're coming up with a new scooter designs, working on launching new cities, and really growing the team. And it's been quite crazy. I mean, I've never grown a team this big before. Really building the future of mobility under this group is quite a really exciting challenge over the next few years.
Oh, excellent. That sounds like a fun thing to do, and one that'll certainly mm-hmm. keep you busy and I'm sure invigorated. Ewan, it's been a real pleasure speaking with you. I think that you're just a great inspiration to our listeners, and I'm sure a lot of people will enjoy this. Is there anything that I should have asked you or we should have talked about that I didn't?
I think you've covered quite a lot. No, I think that was great.
Okay. Well, great. Thanks again, Ewan. And signing off from here, thanks, folks. And we'll see you at our next episode.
Wow, Bela, that was great. Where to start? I learned a lot from the conversation with Ewan. What did you think were the most important points?
So one of the things that really jumped out at me, and being a former VC, I kind of rang my bell a little bit in a good way. When he said, we were talking about VC investing, and he said, I look at it as the VC is investing in my company, but I'm hiring them. So I really take a deep look and a deep dive into the VC firm and try to understand what they're offering, because money's a commodity. You can get that in a bunch of different places. But I really liked his notion of I'm hiring these people, I'm selling them a large portion of my company, and their mission is to help guide me and to help grow this business so at some point in the future, we're going to have an exit. So I thought that was one thing that was really stuck out at me. The other thing that I wanted to talk about quickly is it's this recurring theme we've heard over and over again from many of our guests. It's the internship. Here, he called it a sabbatical, right? He took a sabbatical from his law firm practice for a year. And that's when he moved out west to what I call the epicenter of entrepreneurial activity, right? The Bay Area, the Silicon Valley. And that's when his sort of real his formal entrepreneurship career really started. So I thought those were two big things. Again, this notion of an internship and not really knowing where it's going to lead to. But if you take it, they almost always lead to something good.
Bela, you know what's really interesting? You just used HR metaphors for two really important aspects of kind of entrepreneurship and entrepreneurial career. And I think HR often gets a little bit disrespected amongst all the business functions. And maybe that's for a good reason or not. I'm married to an HR professor. So I before people jump all over me, just know that I have been sleeping with an HR professor for the last 25 plus years.
Oh, and Mike, let's just tell people what HR is, because maybe not everyone knows what that is.
Oh, thank you. Human resources, sometimes called HRM, human resource management. and still in Germany, oftentimes referred to as personnel management. But that term's kind of out of favor in the U.S. Thank you for reminding me of that. But, okay, so HR metaphors, right? I mean, really, when you're hiring a VC, that really is going through a selection process, right? Developing criteria, interviewing, and using different tools to find out whether it's going to be a good fit, right? I think that's a really cool point. And then when you talk about sabbatical as internship, again, we're really looking at this idea of employee development and career development and growth. And now we're really looking to these two important aspects of entrepreneurship as really having these analogs to human resource management. So I think that's kind of a cool takeaway.
Yeah, excellent point, Mike. The other thing I want to bring up is here again, a common theme we've heard from many of our guests, this sort of opportunity recognition. Ewan talked about, you know, he's an observer. He watches things. He looks for the inefficiencies in various different parts of our life. And then he views those as sort of opportunities. And this notion of the spin fitting between Uber and walking. It's that part between Uber and walking. And the other thing I thought was really good was his notion of realizing that this is sort of a new business, but it's in the city, you're using city sidewalks, you're doing things, and I need to figure out how to partner with the cities and the municipalities and be on their side, because we've all heard of some of the challenges that Uber and Lyft has had at various municipalities. And Ewan said, look, I got to figure out how to be their friend and make this a partnership, because they're going to want it, and I need them on my side. So I thought those were two big takeaways.
Yeah, they need you as much as you need them.
Exactly.
Take out that adversarial relationship from the beginning, it's going to go much better. Because there's no standards, right? This isn't a common theme that entrepreneurs face. Now, when you were a medical device guy, there was all kinds of standards and rules in place, right? In this world of I love the word micro-mobility that Ewan used, but in this micro-mobility world, there are no rules and standards yet. And that's why these conflicts have arisen in so many localities. So I thought that was a really cool corollary, or that's not the right word, but this a comparison to kind of some of the innovation that you've done. That in this area where there's no standards, it makes it a lot harder. And that's where these relationships are so much more important.
Yeah, lots of times when you come up with new technology, the regulators, I'll call them, don't know how to handle it. I mean, we had a little bit of that when we started the medical device company. We were doing robotic surgery, and this is in the early 90s, and the FDA didn't know quite what to do with it. So you had to partner with them. And together you help understand and you do what's best in that case for the patient. The other thing I thought that was sort of neat is when he talked about networking. You know, we always think about networking as a thing that we're doing for ourselves in a personal nature. And Ewan really talked about it as when you're an entrepreneur, you're actually networking for your company, and you're helping to build the company's brand and position. And I thought that was another excellent insight.
Yeah, I'd never thought of it that way before, Bela. And I love that when we teach college students how to network so that they can get a job, it's actually a skill. Yes, it helps you get a job, but it's actually a skill for building your organization and being a better entrepreneur, right?
Yeah, I agree.
Love it. All right, I'm going to use that right away and give you in full credit. But I think that's a really cool lesson, that it's not just so you get a job, it's so that you open doors for your organization.
I agree. And, you know, I would say, Mike, in every one of these podcasts that we've done, there's been one or two kind of golden nuggets that I have filed away. And I have said, you know what, I'm going to use that in one of my classes or in a workshop or just for life. I think that's one of the great things that I've enjoyed about doing these. This one went pretty long. So what do you say we wrap this up, Mike?
I think it's a great idea. I think we're really happy that you, our listeners, joined us in our podcasting adventure for this week. And we hope that you found the last hour or so interesting and thought-provoking, like Bela and I did. As usual, we have two small requests. First, if you have questions about what we've just discussed, if you have suggestions about topics or potential guests, please do get in touch with us. We check our email and we answer our email. The best way to get a hold of us is bela.and.mike@gmail.com. And of course, if you like what we're doing here, please hit subscribe or like on your podcast app, or even be radical and consider writing us a quick review. If you know other people that might find this interesting, please share us with them.
Hey, that's it for this week from here in beautiful downtown Schenectady, New York. Thanks for spending time with us. We look forward to having you join us for our next episode. Hey, Mike, see you next week.
Thanks, Bela. Tschüss from Münster, Germany.
This podcast is produced for Mike and I by our friends at Busy Media of Schenectady, New York. They can be found at busymedia.co.